listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
JD Bowman is the delinquent academic. He's training to be a clinical psychologist. He's also doing a PhD in free speech. He joins me now from his very salubrious student flat in Dunedin. JD, great to meet you. Tell us about the background to this PhD you're doing. Because to be perfectly honest, in academia today, a doctorate in free speech is a pretty out there thing to do, isn't it?
Well, it seems like it. You know, the world today, there's, you know, attacks from many different directions on free speech. Although on university campuses, it seems like it's coming from one direction, but we can get into that later. So for my background, how much detail do you want?
Well, I'd like to know what your undergraduate courses were in and how come you've veered in the direction of a doctorate in free speech or about free speech when you're training, I understand, almost concurrently to be a clinical psychologist.
Well, it was, well, so I kind of had these dual, as you recognize, got these dual things going on. And so I used to be a ski instructor, and then I decided I wanted to go back to university. Earlier, I had done a degree in philosophy, and in philosophy, thinking critically, open inquiry is very important. So I kind of already had a base, as it were, of, valuing free speech and open debate, curiosity, creative thinking, and so on. But anyway, it was about 2018, and I had decided that I wanted to become a clinical psychologist. And so I re-enrolled in university. I was doing online university at Massey, doing a graduate diploma in psychology. And this was about 2018. And around that time, things started to get pretty weird, let's just say, overseas. In the UK, Canada, and of course the US at universities, people were getting censored, people were getting cancelled, and people...
It was pretty weird in New Zealand too, though, wasn't it, JD? Because 2018, if I remember correctly, was the year that Don Brash was basically banned from Massey University, or banned the first time anyway, by the, I think she's still the Chancellor, isn't she? Vice-Chancellor, I mean.
Yes, though that didn't have much of an impact on me at the time. YouTube had started to influence. There are a lot of people that had moved from mainstream media organizations onto things like YouTube, Twitter and things like that. And I knew less of what was essentially going on in New Zealand in the free speech domain. And so on and so forth. And so it was more like there were like high profile cancellations of people like Jordan Peterson and Brett Weinstein that really worried me, because of course I was going to do my postgraduate studies at the University of Otago. And after seeing this, and what I had heard described as like the fragility of the younger generations today, it got me a little bit guarded. So when I went to the university, when I got into my honors course, I definitely kept a distance and made sure to keep myself removed from situations and groups where I might say something that would offend someone and then get me a complaint laid against me
basically become a non-person, deplatformed. So this is in Dunedin. This is at the University of Otago.
Yes.
And you started there full-time as a graduate student when? About 2020, was it, or 21?
2021 was my first honours year. And then after that, I started my first year of clinical training, which was more university papers. And then the year after that, I did my first practical year of clinical training. And then this year, I'm doing my first research year of my PhD.
Right. So when you talk about free speech problems, shall we say, at the University of Otago on the campus, or maybe off campus as well, what particular subjects, what particular issues, topics might you have been talking about, or more particularly not talking about, holding your tongue, so to speak, in order not to offend people? What sort of issues are we on about here?
Well, there's so many, it's hard to know where to start. At the moment, my supervisor and I are coming up with a list of topics, and we're actually asking students to rate their controversy level on campus. And so we've generated 80, and then from those 80, we'll take maybe 25 and do a further study, investigating the reasons why, and so on and so forth.
80 topics that could be deemed, if you don't provide the right narrative, they could be deemed to be offensive to people. 80 topics?
Well,
heaven forbid.
What
Can
is
you
true?
Give us an example of them?
Well, there's plenty of examples. One is what we talked about earlier, which is university messaging about sexual assault, overly critical of young men. So that would be one topic. Is a two-state solution in the Middle East viable? There's plenty of topics.
What about COVID? I mean, you're talking 2021. This is the year of COVID. It's the year of the vaccine rollout. Was that on the list?
Yes, we've got topics that refer to whether mandates are mandates to have the vaccine, whether that should be enforced. You know, so for example, if there's another coronavirus or infection of some sort, should it be mandated again? So we've got questions on that. We've got questions on a range of things that you could imagine any person could get angry or offended about, not just people of a certain political persuasion.
So do you actually have experiences where you might be in a social setting and you talk about, say, the Palestinian-Israeli situation and the two-state solution? I mean, to me, that is such an unbelievably complicated scenario with a history dating back 3,000 years. No mere university student in New Zealand could possibly know the nuances, the subtleties, even the history of what's gone on in that troubled part of the world. So why the hell shouldn't you have a lively discussion about what you do know through what you've read? Why should people take such strong sides on this, almost to the point of deplatforming, not socializing with somebody who has the opposite opinion? Because it is such a complicated world that there's no point in losing friendships over it, is there?
Yes. You would hope that people don't lose friends because they simply disagree with you. However, whether or not you get socially ostracized, for me, that's not really the issue. I don't mind if people call me certain names or gossip behind my back if we can actually discuss these topics, if we can actually have open debate, if the students and other staff can hear these debates and then, based on the debate, make up their own minds for what's going on. So, you know, losing friends, that sucks, but that's also part of life. And, you know, I'm not going to try force anybody to be friends with me if they don't want to be, if they don't like my views and so on. But the with the Israel-Palestine thing, you're right. You know, this is such a complicated issue, and in my view, we need more discussion rather than less in order to understand what's going on. Because at the moment, it's you're either with that side or you're with that side.
Yeah, and I know around Dunedin, on the streets of the city that you live in, there have been fairly regular and noisy marches most weekends in recent times. What about issues closer to home, though, JD? What about race relations in this country, the Treaty of Waitangi and David Seymour's Treaty Principles Bill?
Yeah, so if I was going to take a guess, I would guess discussing whether this bill should be voted upon, or whether universities should be treaty-led, or whether Māori should have their own safe spaces and special classes, whether they should have resources, more resources given to them over other ethnic groups, I would guess that those topics would be among the most taboo, controversial to discuss on campus. Now, I don't know for sure. That's just my guess. But after being on campus for a while, and I wouldn't be surprised if Otago is actually one of the more open campuses at New Zealand. But anyway, after being on campus, it really does feel like, you know, I discuss, you know, sometimes my friends say that I fire from the hip, but even I, you know, haven't gone there now. Yeah, so I would agree that race relations, especially between Māori and Pākehā, is something that is, you know, not only under the rug, but it's in a chiller under the rug.
By the way, do you know what a university being Te Tiriti-led means?
Not exactly, though.
Because Otago has made a point of it, haven't they?
I don't know how that stands with the recent statement promoting and supporting free speech exactly.
Okay, you'd think there may have been a slight subtle change of policy, because they've always made a big play, haven't they? I mean, Grant Robertson's been the vice chancellor for just a couple of months now, and I'm sure he wouldn't be walking back previous policies from his predecessors, would he?
No, I wouldn't think so. They also changed the logo, and they made a very big show of that, about that, when there was financial issues going on at the same time. I don't know exactly what treaty-led means, although I would guess that it would be providing extra resources and support for Māori where they can.
Right. So I've never met you before this interview, but I know your parents, and your dad's Māori, isn't he? So therefore, you would surely qualify for assistance being a Māori. Mm-hmm. So have you taken advantage of that? Do you don't look Māori, but do you put it about that you do have Māori blood, Māori heritage, and do you cash in on it, so to speak?
Well, it is something that my friends know about, and I talk to my friends about, and it's also something that I'm proud about. And I'm actually getting my PhD is a Māori PhD. So I'm getting.
What do you mean, a Māori PhD? It's being funded by an iwi?
I don't know exactly where the money's coming from, to be perfectly honest. However, it's a Māori PhD rather than just a PhD reserved for other students. I applied for that one first, and I applied for the other one as
so
well.
So tell me about that policy. What you're saying is you applied to do a PhD just as a run-of-the-mill JD Bowman bloke who may or may not have had Māori heritage. You put up a particular topic, in this case free speech, and you didn't get accepted, despite the fact that you have a pretty stellar academic record behind you. And when they said no, you said, I'll give it another go through the Māori channel?
No, it was more like, so when you do the application process, you can choose whether to, you can put two applications in at once, but you have to prioritize one. So you can put an application through the Māori one first, or you could put an application through the Pākehā and others one, for lack of a better phrase. And so I put that one first, and I put the Māori one second, and I got approved straight away for the Māori one. So whether that means I'm not good enough for the other one, or whether that means, you know, they just want more Māori people to be doing PhDs, I'm not exactly sure. I am grateful to be doing a PhD, that's for sure. I'm grateful where I am. So, you know, it's working out for me right now.
Sure, but does it frustrate you that maybe you only got this grant to do your PhD and your place on the course because you've been able to show some Māori heritage? Is that patronizing, do you think, towards you in any way?
If that was the case, and if I could prove that, yes. At the moment, I don't actually know. You know, there have been whispers, there have been rumors. I did argue a couple of years ago against affirmative action in clinical applications to a few of my classmates because it would be, as you just described, patronizing to Māori that they couldn't actually achieve the same standards as other ethnic groups. And to my knowledge, at least at the University of Otago, there is no affirmative action discrimination based on race in that way.
Well, there is in the med school, isn't there?
Yes.
I mean, that cannot be denied, can it? Because there is evidence, isn't there, that Pākehā students with, you know, very good grade averages from high school or even from their first year of health sciences do not get admitted to med school, despite the fact that some Māori students with worse academic records than them do get admitted. And I just wonder what your feeling is about that.
I think their argument is something like, at the moment, Māori are overrepresented in various bad outcomes to do with mental health, to do with socioeconomic status, and so on and so forth. And one way we're going to rectify this, in the medical school case, is they're underrepresented in doctors, and we want Māori to be coming forward and being getting seen by more Māori doctors. So what we're going to do is we're going to lift Māori up a bit, and we're going to allow them to enter into the medical school at a slightly lower level compared to the other ethnic groups. And this will mean that there'll be more Māori doctors and that Māori can see the Māori doctors. However, that, if you use racism as defined in the dictionary, that is technically discrimination based on race, which before a few years ago was illegal, I thought. I might be wrong about that.
Well, it still is illegal under the Human Rights Act, I would have thought, in this country. The other point about that particular issue, it doesn't apply especially to Otago, although it might. I have read that for some years now at Auckland University Medical School, and I'm sorry we've got right off the topic of your PhD on free speech here.
You're okay.
But it's a worthwhile issue to discuss. I've read that at the Auckland University Medical School, something like 30% of the students are now Māori and Pacific Island, and it has been that way for at least a decade. Yet we're still told we've only got 3 to 4% of our doctors Maori and Pacific Islands. So one wonders what the heck is happening here. Are these people getting access to medical school, doing their course and leaving the country, or are they not getting through their course despite their seeming advantage in being admitted in the first place? Do you know what's going on there?
No, I haven't actually heard of that example, and if that was true, that would be quite troubling. So I heard some research in the United States. Now, this is quite vague in my head right now, so I don't know if I'm going to get it accurate. But I remember there was some research that was done into affirmative action policies for African-Americans at American universities. And what they found that was that there was a greater dropout rate, because if you let in someone with an ability that is not quite at the level where they really need to be, there's going to be, you know, some attrition. And so I wonder if that's happening here.
Okay.
So do you know if there's any, are they completing the course or not?
I don't know. I just it was just a newspaper article. In fact, it was one line, I think, in a report of the New Zealand Herald about the time this issue came up yet again. And it said that 30% of the medical students at Auckland University were Māori and PI. And I put that alongside the often reported number of only 3 to 4% of medical professionals in New Zealand are Māori and PI. And I'm thinking those two numbers don't add up here. So there's something strange going on. But remember, of course, the affirmative action in the United States has claimed some pretty high-profile victims, hasn't it, with the president, effectively the vice-chancellor of Harvard, losing her job because of affirmative action policies, which were really discriminating against the whites, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Do you know of that case? Have you read about that case?
The Claudine Gay one?
I believe so, yeah.
I don't know that intimately, but what I have heard is that American universities are starting to roll back some of their affirmative action policies. They've got pushback for so long now that it's very hard to argue against, as I said before, the argument that this is discrimination based on race, and that, you know, we're supposed to live in a society of fairness where meritocracy is the thing we value above group identity.
All right, so you are doing this PhD in free speech. The discussion we've been having for the last 5 to 8 minutes about affirmative action, can you have that out loud on campus at Otago and not be shut down or cancelled or told to go to another town and put your nasty thoughts away?
Yeah, if you whisper it really, really quietly. On that, those topics, I'm not sure, but I'm at the moment, I'm trying to find this out, you know. We've got, as I said before, we've got 80 topics. We're asking the students right now the controversy level of those topics. And I'm assuming those topics will be pretty high up there on the list.
What about other big cultural issue, the other big cultural issue of the moment, that is gender dysphoria, trans activism? I mean, is that discussed much on campus? Are you allowed to have a view which is against the prevailing narrative on that without being cancelled and shunned?
That you're right. That is you can have one view.
You can have one view.
Yes, you can have one view. This is an important one, and especially for, you know, becoming a clinical psychologist. So a couple of years ago, or was it last year? It might have been last year. I was in a seminar and it was discussing how clinical psychologists should approach treating people, transgender people, and that are suffering from, you know, gender dysphoria.
What age are we talking about here, JD?
All ages, so including children. I'm sure you've heard the argument. What we're supposed to do is to affirm their belief that they are in the wrong body.
Even if they're 12 years old?
Even if they're, yeah. And so without hearing it, I was waiting for the other side. There was no other side, so I thought, feel like I got to say something here. I spoke up and said, you know, what if they're wrong? What if they're wrong about this and we as medical professionals have affirmed their wrong belief and then they go on to get gender reassignment surgery and 5 years later they realize they were wrong? Their life would be ruined.
After five years of puberty blockers.
Right, or any gender reassignment surgery is the most extreme, but yes, there's puberty blockers and there's all types of things that can change, but not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. So in other words, if somebody at 12 or 13 just entering puberty happens to come to somebody like you, presumably will finish up being a clinical psychologist or a psychotherapist or whatever, and says, I'm in the wrong body, and you try to push back against them or say, just, you know, hang about, wait for 5 years, see what you're feeling like at 17, 18 mm-hmm. years of age.
Yep.
You're telling me that as a clinical psychologist, as a registered professional in that field in this country, you're not allowed to say that?
I don't know about being a registered professional. I don't know exactly what's going on there. All I know is that in this seminar at this time, what I said, which was maybe we should challenge their view. Maybe, as you said, maybe you should wait and so on and so forth. That view was called transphobic, and that view was I'm hoping that there are independent clinical psychologists and psychiatrists and doctors out there that are being ethical medical practitioners and pushing back where they should push back. I haven't read the relevant code of practice or whatever it's called on this specific issue in the New Zealand Board of Clinical Psychologists website or whatever. But at least what I was hearing on the university is that there's one direction. And be very careful if you try to go the other way.
So you are training to become a clinical psychologist. You're doing the PhD at the moment, but you will in time have to presumably sit some exams or present some thesis work to get your graduate degree in psychology, your postgrad in clinical psychology. If there is a particular question or assignment about this and you put forward the views that you've just espoused here, could you actually fail the course because of that, because of your personal views on it?
So I've feared about this for a long time. And I've discussed it with my family and my friends that there's high-profile cases. I don't know about New Zealand, but certainly overseas, where clinical psychologists have lost their ability to practice because they don't sign up to the prevailing narrative or they hold a different view. Obviously, the most famous case is Jordan Peterson. I do worry that even having this conversation with you will put me in a position where they could use this as an excuse not to let me become a clinical psychologist. However, I do think it's necessary that we discuss these at times unpleasant topics. It's necessary to try and find out the truth, because with this gender dysphoria thing, it is likely there have been some people that really are going to suffer for the rest of their lives because a clinical psychologist affirmed them.
On the program where this interview will be replayed on RCR, JD, there is an interview with a woman who is the executive director of an outfit called GenSpec. She's based in rural Ireland. Her name is Stella O'Malley, and she is a clinical psychotherapist, mm-hmm. which must be closely related to the work that you are doing. And she herself has admitted that at the age of 10, she thought she should be a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And she is, I think, one of the reasons she is now in the work that she's in, working in the field that she's in, and as the head of this outfit called GenSpec, is that because she was just 10 when this happened and the whole gender dysphoria thing was not an issue when she was 10 years of age, she was basically just told to wait a few years. And she started dating when she was a teenager. She enjoyed going through puberty as a woman, and she enjoyed discovering that she was a woman and heterosexual and had children and fell in love, et cetera, et cetera. And she is forever grateful that she did not go down the line of puberty blockers, or that she was assisted by a psychology professional or a medical professional to go the way that seems to be the approved way of doing it in New Zealand in 2024. So there's one example. She also says that she has to deal a lot these days with detransitioners.
Yes.
So it would appear that there is so much evidence that the approved way of treating this gender dysphoria can create many, many more problems, unintended consequences, which a lot of professionals are not prepared to listen to. And this seems to be already, you know, the cause or the atmosphere that you're encountering.
Yes. And I don't know the history in a detailed manner, but I know that, yeah, as you say, as this woman was describing, it wasn't that long ago where there was a substantial code of practice about what to do in these cases. As you say, wait 5 years or so on and so forth, and maybe it will, you know, come right. Maybe you will be gay, or maybe you'll turn out straight, and so on and so forth. But there's been, as you know, a sharp rise in cases. There's probably many different reasons for that. And I don't know if it's the professionals themselves. I'm sure there'll be a minority of radicals that actually think they're doing the right thing.
By encouraging it? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they fully believe that, you know, this is real, and that this person is a girl when they are in a boy's body, and so on and so forth. And then there will probably be a significant minority or even a majority of professionals that are like, this looks dodgy, because it was only yesterday where we were going, hold on, hold on. Now, when they try to speak up, this is where the free speech comes in, where they try to speak up, you know, they're called transphobic. And then haven't looked into New Zealand, but, you know, they might be threatened with losing their license.
Yeah, and you've
had... it's all good. It's all good. I won't say anything. I like my cushy job. I'm getting paid quite a lot as a clinical psychologist right now.
Mm, and you've had early experience of what it could be like. And you at the student stage, at the postgraduate stage. And that leads nicely, I think, into Otago University's recently very highly publicized free speech policy. And I think it was about the time that Grant Robertson became the vice chancellor. It was a big deal that there was a policy which was published in the Otago Daily Times. I think it got a bit of coverage elsewhere as well. Otago University was making quite a play on the fact that, hey, we welcome academic freedom. We welcome variety of thought on our campus, amongst our students, and among our faculty. We want to entertain all ideas. People are going to be free to express whatever they think on campus about controversial ideas. Gee, it sounds pretty good on the surface, JD. You've been amongst it for a little while. Are they practicing what they preach, or is that example of what you've said about treating gender dysphoria an example of the fact that this policy is actually a load of tosh and it's just window dressing?
I don't think it's window dressing, but because now I actually have something that I can point to when somebody tries to shut it down and so on and so forth, I can say, hey, there's a statement here. Read this. It says clearly that I'm allowed to express my opinion, even if you don't like it, even if you're offended by it, even if you think it's dangerous.
And is everybody on campus well aware of this policy? I'm talking faculty and students and administration staff. They're all well aware that this free speech policy is out there and it's been well publicised, and this is the way Otago University people operate.
I don't know, actually. What is, certain? I'm a demonstrator, which is essentially just a psychology tutor, and I've been doing it for 4 years now, ever since I moved here. I'm in my fourth year now. And the students, largely, they just want to get on the beers, and they don't really, care about what's there. They wouldn't, a large majority wouldn't even know what's going on, whether there was a free speech statement or not.
You're talking undergraduates. You're supervising teaching now. At undergraduate level.
Yep.
Are they really that slack?
Well, yes, I think so. And then there is a minority, incredibly vocal minority that will be probably, I'm guessing now, very aware, and they'll be very angry because this allows, as I said before, ideas that they really despise, or the possibility that ideas that they really despise can be spoken and then heard on campus. So I'm sure that group is aware of it. And then the disconnected academics and students like myself that are really passionate about free speech and open inquiry will know about it. Of course, there's the working group that came up with the statement. But yeah, as I said before, now I've got something to point to when before I really didn't, or it was very weak.
Yeah. Do you think that there will be any difference in attitude once you do point out that policy? Because I take it then that your pushback against that particular treatment or attitude towards gender dysphoria was made before this free speech policy became public 2 or 3 months ago.
Yes, it was. It was made at least a year ago.
Even so, JD, under the Education and Training Act of 2020, it still says that universities have got to be the critic and conscience of society, and that controversial ideas should be discussed and put about, and what's more, received on campus as well. So anybody pushing back against you surely was actually breaking the law, weren't they?
Well, in this case, it was another student. And Yeah, what I do want to make clear is at the moment, I haven't actually been cancelled, you know. There have been a few rare moments of censorship. But what happens mostly is self-censorship. So have you heard of Eric Kaufman's iceberg model of censorship?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's something like, so on the surface, you'll see public cancellations, public denouncements, and you might see some people shouting down speakers and deplatformings and so on and so forth. And then so that's one type of censorship, and that's something that, you know, everybody can see. So it's the tip of the iceberg. But underneath the surface is a very large body of censorship, and this is self-censorship. So this is all the academics and other staff and students that are worried that if they go against the narrative on this issue or that issue, it's not going to be good for them. They might get lower grades. If they're a student, they might get called a racist, a transphobe, misogynist, and so on and so forth. Their reputation will be destroyed. If they're staff, they may not get research grants. They may not get a promotion. Their paper might be taken away from them. And so I do think that self-censorship could be the greater problem, because
people are just too scared to say what they really think.
Yeah, and I like to believe I'm someone who speaks out quite a lot, and I do it almost instinctively. And even I'm self-censoring a lot. So if I'm self-censoring a lot, I kind of look around me and I'm like,
yeah. Who's setting the narrative, by the way? Who are these people who say this is the approved way to think on campus at Otago University?
Well, the short answer would be, you know, the woke left. That's an easy answer.
Who are they, though? I mean, Grant Robertson would be a member of that, but he's only been there a couple of months. Was his predecessor as the vice chancellor in that camp, and I think she was only acting for some time, wasn't she, after the previous vice-chancellor was there for a short time. He resigned because of ill health, and then you had a Canadian, Harlene Hain, before that. So, you know, Otago's turned over the VCs in recent years, hasn't it? But are they all singing from the same song sheet, do you think?
I wouldn't know. So, you know, specific people definitely interest me less. I think it is, you know, I don't want to make out the institution as if it's a total force for evil, or that everybody there, all the staff, are rotten and they're all intolerant and so on and so forth. As I said earlier, you know, there is an intolerant minority that is weaponizing terms, as I used before, like racism, transphobe, misogynist, very powerful, loaded terms, and using them against, you know, the majority of peoples that just want to learn, get a degree, go out into the world, or they want to do their own research about, you know, some random fauna and on some random island or whatever it is. And so, yeah, it's this small group of radical people that I think are the problem, and they're using such tactics as, you know, social ostracism, and then going up to superiors and complaining. There's been a rise in student complaints, which have been a direct, what would you call it, import from the United States.
A rise in student complaints about non-approved narratives, non-approved attitudes. Is that what you say? Not student complaints about being shut down or failing papers, failing tests because they've given unapproved answers.
Complaints, for example, like complaints that, you know, a lecture might be, homophobic, or, you know, it might make them re-experience a trauma that they had in the past or something like that. Or, you know, a lecture didn't include a trigger warning, or, you know, It can be Jeepers. Anything under the sun, really.
You got some pretty precious snowflakes at Otago, have you?
Well, it does
you
snow.
You can say yes.
Yeah, what I want to say is, you know, who should have the authority to define what is offensive and not offensive, of what can be spoken about and what can't be? Seems to
that's
me
that's a very good question. Well, that's a very good question, because doesn't that come to the heart of the free speech debate? And the question that we have to ask is, what is truth? What is a reasonable and worthwhile opinion? Is there such a thing as a wrong opinion? If you have evidence, why can evidence not be used in an argument? Why is it that so many people look at the evidence and say, well, I just don't believe that, and diss it? And heaven forbid, we've seen enough of those arguments in recent times around COVID matters, haven't we? But there just seems to be a group of people who just will not be turned, as Margaret Thatcher used to say.
Yes, well, the institutions and they're supposed to be, pursuing truth, but the people that inhabit those institutions are still people. They still operate with the same motivations as everybody else. Scientists are not simply, truth-seeking automatons. They want money, they want status, and they want power. And so if the incentives are warped at the university, then it might distort the whole thing and allow for people who don't care about truth, who just care about controlling this little region at the south of the world and the south of our country.
In other words, there's an awful lot of self-interest here and a lot of people who are quite happy, and you talked before about them being paid pretty well in academia, or if they've got an academic qualification which was approved and they've gone out into the corporate world and they make good salaries and the like. People just get a bit too comfortable in their own skin because of circumstances. So there's not enough challenge to thought in the modern world. Is that a fair summation of where you see things?
Yes, and I don't know this in detail, but also research grants. So the university at the moment, like what I see is that I think what it's doing is it's prioritizing kindness and compassion above truth. So, if truth is secondary, then ideas and research that might cause offense or might cause harm to certain groups of people can be pushed to the side, can be suppressed, because kindness and compassion is the thing we're really going after. You know, it's not, truth is cool, and it's nice to have that too, but kindness and compassion is the thing that we really want. And so we're not going to give money to people who might be researching something that could be true, but if that offends, or if that is painful, or if that is unpleasant, then we're not going to give money to those people, as I said.
Okay, so we've talked about a couple of issues which are very much in the culture war in this country at the moment: race relations and matters of gender and transgender. And yes, I can see that some people might be offended by others' attitudes, others' thinking on those issues. What about another very controversial topic? Surely people cannot be offended if somebody says that anthropogenic global warming is not a thing, that CO2 is not having an impact on the world's temperature. People cannot have feelings hurt about that, can they? Even if there might be quite a lot of empirical evidence to prove that that is the case.
Well, I get offended when people say Kane Williamson is not the best cricket batsman in the world. So people can get offended by anything.
Well, he's not currently because they can't get a match started in this blinking hellhole.
I've been waiting
on the outskirts of New Delhi.
The start of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, on that specific issue, I don't know much about that. And I don't know, you know, it seems, yes, it does seem absurd to me that people can get offended about something like that. But, you know, I'm coming to realize that, yeah, as I said before, that anything could be a issue for somebody. You know, ideas are very individual in a lot of different ways. And so they can, you know, annoy anybody. But I just go back to the point I made before. If we cater to everybody's offense, then no ideas are going to be heard. At the moment, we're catering to certain groups and certain ideologues' offense, and then some ideas are getting suppressed. You could imagine a world where, okay, this is a total safe space and nothing that offends is going to be allowed to be, you know, expressed. And I don't even know if people can talk in that world, but you could imagine a world like you know, maybe you can't, but you need to be able to risk offending people if you're going to be able to think.
Of course, and a couple of quite famous people from history did offend their colleagues at the time, didn't they? And I'm referring to Galileo, and I'm referring to Nicholas Copernicus. They put about some theories which for the time were, frankly, they were whack job theories, weren't they?
Yes, 100%. But, yeah.
And they suffered for it, didn't they? Didn't Copernicus die in prison? I don't know. Something tells me that he was certainly persecuted big time, and so was Galileo. But they were both right, weren't they?
Yes. And Newton and Einstein. You could almost argue that it's a general rule that when a big discovery is made, it's almost from someone from coming with this weird out of nowhere idea.
So shouldn't history teach us a few things then, JD? Shouldn't history say, if your idea is really from left field, the examples we've talked about in the last minute or so, shouldn't those examples say, well, heck, there's been a few pretty mad ideas in the past, which have in the end proved to be perfectly correct. Maybe we should investigate this. Surely enlightened thinkers of 2024 would take that attitude, wouldn't they?
You would hope so. But, you know, as I said before, people's livelihoods are on the line, or they perceive that their livelihoods are on the line. You know, people were probably worried, you know, they got a lot of status in their position, professorship or whatever they're doing, and they don't want to lose that. And so, and they also have their little area of scientific inquiry where it might actually, and it's really, it might be really technical, you know, and in that little domain, they can talk freely because it, you know, talking about rat membranes or whatever the thing they're talking about isn't going to offend anybody, and they can kind of live in that little bubble and they're all happy and blah 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 because they're not, you know, getting out there and discussing social issues, for instance, that are far more polarizing.
So do you know of academic colleagues, and I'm talking mainly about faculty members, I guess, who would fall into the very high percentages which have been revealed in various surveys about how academics feel about academic freedom on campus? This is a study done, I think, by, was it the New Zealand Initiative? It might have been another organisation, which asked academics how they feel about speaking up on controversial issues on campus. And it would appear as if there is a significant cohort who feel cowed, bullied into staying stum.
Are you talking about all the individual statements?
Yeah, well, there was one recently at AUT Law School, wasn't there? But there have been other ones before that as well, which have pretty much come up with the same results, that the vast, is it a vast majority? Certainly a majority of academics feel as if they are not comfortable speaking out. And I've spoken with Professor Grant Schofield from AUT about this. He runs the School of Public Health there. He's of an age now where, frankly, he doesn't care. So he's lucky he can do that. And there are people of my generation who, frankly, don't care too much about what we say anymore either. But to somebody like yourself, a young man starting out on what you hope will be a successful career in clinical psychology, that's a real threat hanging over your head, isn't it? And there might be many academics who are 10, 15 years older than you who feel the same. They have a good chunk of their career ahead of them as well. So is it a matter of practicality, of just thinking about what the reality of life is in 2024? And until there's a change of attitude in society, you just have to suck it up.
No, I actually don't think so. I truly believe that if, you know, you stand up and you actually say something, and you actually, even if it's just asking questions, I think if a critical mass of people do that, then things will change and you won't have to keep quiet all the time, and you don't have to worry that you might not have a future in academia.
Where's just the critical mass going to come from, though?
You know, I don't know. Hopefully people can, other students can listen to this and they can speak up in class. You know, I think people are frustrated with the chill of speech, not just on campus, but in, you know, their workplaces and so on and so forth. And, you know, eventually you would hope, you know, this is my hope, that, you know, more and more people can come out and say that this is wrong and this isn't beneficial for our society. And then the institutions can replenish and rejuvenate and, you know, become, in the case of the tertiary institutions, truth-seeking rather than dominated by an ideology.
Well, wouldn't that be good? We had a thing a couple of hundred years ago, or maybe it was further back than that, called the Enlightenment, didn't we? I feel at times as if somebody has turned the light off in New Zealand academia. Do you feel the same way?
Yes, well,
if not turn it off, at least dim the lights.
Yeah, at least dim the light. I will say in my, you know, I'm lucky, as I said earlier, I think, that, you know, my professor is, and my supervisor is Jamin Halberstadt. And I think without him, I wouldn't be able to do this topic. I am fairly certain, maybe there might be one or two others, but I'm fairly certain I won't be able to do this topic. And in my little bubble, while I have felt, you know, arrows coming at me from different directions, he's still supported me this whole time. So, it's kind of like there's a big room and it's all dark, but I'm just hovering around a little.
So is Jamin's a professor in the Department of Psychology?
He is. He is the HOD.
Okay, and so he's absolutely got your back.
I literally asked him in those words.
Great. All right, so you say you've been doing research for the last few months on this PhD in free speech. What's the schedule? When are we likely to see a thesis presented to the world?
Hopefully I don't get cancelled, but probably in 2 more years.
Towards the end of 2026?
Yep. And we'll see how it goes. I'm sure there'll be a lot of people that will be annoyed and offended. But, you know,
good. That. Good. The more the merrier.
Well, you're doing something right, for sure.
Yeah. And then after that, JD, do you finish off your postgrad in clinical psychology and then go out into the big wide world?
Yeah, I'll do my internship and I'll get posted somewhere. And I'll be, as you said, out in the world finally after being, you know, institutionalized for way too long.
I love the title of your Substack, The Delinquent Academic. Have you been a bit delinquent along the way? You said that you did your bachelor's degree and then ducked off to be a ski bum for a while. Do you think you're over that, or do you always want to go back to the mountains?
Yeah, I have to. I've said this many times. I have to be near a mountain, I think, for my own mental health. The name's just a bit of fun. I've traveled around the world. I've had a lot of fun. I guess I picked the name just because it was funny and I just moved on. But, you know, you could refer to it in the sense I'm being delinquent under the university's, you know, view of delinquent. So I'm not going with the way they want me to go and so on and so forth.
Well, good luck. I hope like heck you are not cancelled, you are not shut down, and that your Department of Psychology head of department, the Professor Jaben Halberstadt, remains very supportive of your work. I'd have to say, after having talked to you for the last hour or so, it appears, I know it is very, very important work, which I'm sure many people, not least of which the Free Speech Union, who are pushing this cause big time and fighting back against many examples of people having their their speech repressed, they will be very interested in the fact that you are doing this this academic research. So good luck, head down, work well, and who knows, we might talk again in a couple of years' time when it's all done.
Thanks, Peter.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.